This made me instantly recoil. Kay looked at me shamefaced. He apologized and told me that normally people could not see into his past as I just had. He had learned an attitude that kept him on a positive keel. Then he proceeded to explain that before he came to this level, he was in a place that was the proverbial hell. He confessed that he had been an outright evil bastard when still alive. Back then he was only interested in looking after himself and his whole life was focused on exploiting other people and taking advantage of them in order to further his own agenda, even sacrificing friends and family in its pursuit. He thought nothing of causing great suffering and pain to anybody. Even murder meant nothing to him, causing pain in the process just came with the job. He said he was killed in a brawl and the next thing he knew he was in the company of people who were exclusively of the same ilk as he was, living in a dark, foul and despicable place. As he spoke I received the images. He scuttled through dark derelict places, dirty rags barely covering his diseased body. Open sewage was spilling through the streets and at every corner was someone picking a fight for scraps of food, which were mostly moldy or rotting. There was continuous fighting and tormenting each other, often quarreling over worthless rubbish, trying to get the better of each other, arguing, swearing and beating each other mercilessly, even severing heads and limbs, only to be restored back to normal and then carrying on as before. Their relationships were based on mistrust, resentment, hatred and anger. The worst thing was that they were addicted to their interaction with each other and spent most of their time in the pursuit of argument, putting each other down and trying to get the better of each other. There was no let up and no escape. No matter how far Kay would run, there was only more of the same. Sometimes he would walk for many miles, or run for what seemed to be days, but never reached the horizon, never escaped the gloom. As soon as he stopped and looked around, he found he had only run a few hundred yards away from his clan. Again and again he grew tired of it and made efforts to break away from his compatriots, but there were always one or two who caught up with him and wouldn't let him go or leave him alone. In despair, he rolled up in a heap and shielded himself off from the others, wishing for his torment to end. Finally a stranger turned up, looking quite distinct from the others, with quite a different demeanor. He spoke in a normal voice to him, not shouting, yelling, arguing or trying to get the better of him. He spoke to him in a calm voice and soon Kay started to pour his heart out to him. Then the stranger would leave him alone, mostly when he became angry. In time Kay felt more secure when he was near the stranger and the others would leave him alone. Eventually he asked him if there was any way he could take him away with him so he would be able to cut himself loose from his companions. The stranger told him that he could, but there would be conditions. The conditions were that he should start thinking about his past life and the people he had wronged. Kay agreed, but almost instantly regretted it as images of his many victims began flooding him. Before he knew it, he was in greater agony than he had ever been before. He started cursing the stranger, telling him that he had tricked him, but the stranger simply let him understand that he was only experiencing what he had made others feel and that he had to confront his past deeds if he wanted to move on. When he had moments of rest, the stranger would calmly talk to him again without any judgment and remind him of his promise that there was a way out of all this, but it was a very long road. Kay frequently became angry, resenting the fact that he had to suffer the consequences of his own past actions in such a powerful experiential way, and suspecting that it was a trick and that the stranger was no better than all the others here out to torture him. The stranger responded calmly and reassured him that he had his best interests at heart, but that the first thing he needed to do was to start learning to respect other people, and the best way to start was by showing respect to his benefactor, who was here to help him. Kay finally saw that he had few other options and agreed to give it a try. When the stranger started to coach him by giving him hope and showing him little glimpses of light, he calmed down more. Kay eventually started appreciating the stranger and began to refer to him as the worker because he worked so hard to get Kay to see his own shortcomings and tried so hard to get him onto the straight and narrow. The worker never tired in making Kay face the reality of what his life had been and what had to be done to get out of it. Frequently Kay was unable to deal with it any longer and told the worker to leave him and never come back, which he did, and then Kay was on his own again and the environment began to darken around him as before. Soon he was drifting back towards the old place. When he realized what was happening, he called out again for the worker and begged for forgiveness. Every time they talked, Kay noticed they had moved further away from his old haunts. They were on a road towards a shimmer of light at the horizon, a very faint strip as before dawn, long before the sun showed up, but light nevertheless, and a glimmer of hope. On the road they met other people and the worker showed him how to be kind and helpful. He told Kay that in order to get out of his old life and redeem himself, he needed to learn how to be of service to other people without thinking of his own advantage. They went through poor dwelling places and dark towns and cities, but at least these were a little better than the place he had come from. Here he was shown how to care for others and appreciate the value of positive thoughts, which he learned by focusing on wilting plants and trees without leaves. He knew that when the flowers perked up and the dried trees sprouted green leaves, that he had begun to learn new skills, and it started to light a single spark in his heart. Gradually his appearance improved and he was no longer dressed in old rags. Kay let me know that the road he had traveled had been very long and hard. Before his benefactor friend left him, he told him that a long time ago he was not that much different to him, which gave Kay a lot of hope and strength. And now he was here in a very prosperous and beautiful place, but all the joys to be had here meant not as much as serving the interests and joys of other people. The only thing that makes me happy is looking after their needs and not expecting anything in return, and truly give them something. He said he had now learned that giving from the heart was so much more rewarding than receiving a few worthless objects. I give these people the best food and the best wine, and I like nothing more than feeling the flame in my chest grow slowly and steadily with every day. I never knew that people showing appreciation could mean so much. One day, when I am fully recovered from my madness, I will go back to my dark haunts to meet my old comrades I fought with, and they won't recognize me. I will then try to pay the worker back by doing to them what he did to me. Then he looked me in the eye and said, "As you have just seen when you looked at me, I am still a devil and something in me needs to go back to the place I have come from and confront it. There is plenty more I have to do to become a normal human being." I was stunned by the revelation and this guy's honesty, but I was more surprised by the realization that the hundreds of people acting as servants were here as part of a gigantic project to serve other people and, in so doing, help themselves. I wondered for a moment whether the whole project was solely created as a rehabilitation city in order to give joy and pleasures to others and learn these most valuable of human skills, to give with an open heart. With this thought, I knew I had to terminate my excursion and take notes. So much had happened. I sat down on my own and recalled every moment from when I arrived to where I was sitting now. And when I had come to the end, I went through it one more time. Then I returned to my body, lay still with my eyes closed and ran through it all once more. Then I got to my notepad and wrote everything down. There were a number of things I had brought back from this experience. The first and most noticeable fact was that I had acquired new skills. I have confirmed this since with other out-of-body experiences. In my OB state I was fully clairvoyant. Just by looking at Kay I could instantly see his whole past history. As he spoke to me I picked up the whole narrative of his story in one big chunk, while perceiving every detail as clearly as if I was there. This was a new level of OB I had not observed before. I would use this skill later to interview people during OBs and found that I could quickly and radically obtain information by sinking into their minds and connecting to their recollection as they were, picking up their experiences as if they were my own, but with a level of great detachment. My frequent transcendences beyond personal identification during my daily meditation meant that I could enter even very low and bleak states and environments without being affected by their negativity in the least. This ability became more pronounced and stronger with each Obi. With enhanced perception, I was able to venture into even the most gruesome and sinister levels without a scratch or the slightest hint of psychological damage or depression. Headline: Misconceptions About Life After Death. Afterlife states are as numerous as human beings, and as complex. The most important things we will have to reassess, and most probably shake off, is a widely held belief that our afterlife will magically change everything and reset all our parameters. Individual reports by near-death experiencers and channeling mediums are very specific and will almost certainly never apply to ourselves. Some of the medium reports I found were very confirmative to what I have experienced. There is still the rather romantic view that with the end of our life our suffering will come to an end and we will live in eternal peace. RIP is a fallacy which has been implanted in us from early childhood, mainly as a result of ignorance and our inability to look beyond the great curtain. When people proclaim at funeral services, "Well, at least now he or she is at peace," mostly this is not the case unless the deceased was already at peace at the time of death. What in fact happens is that nothing changes and at the same time everything changes. In some ways. My perception when visiting tourist city was that I was indeed on a level in which most decent people would probably find themselves when they had finished on earth and had dealt with all their various personal issues. Though this is not a given. Again and again, I was directed into regions to take note of all the things that many will need to face before they are in a position to relish the beautiful land and its people. I found that with the majority of people who are mostly driven by powerful needs for self-gratification and subjected to strong drives over which they have little control, their first encounter with the afterlife reality is anything but the proverbial summerland. The most sobering realization was that the many people who have no concept of life after death and have never spent a single thought about any possibility of survival will be faced with the curious fact that nothing seems to have changed at all from the worldly place they lived in before, except that everything they experience now is tinged by their state of mind. The biggest challenge for these people is to accept that they are no longer alive in the physical reality. For them, this is not obvious at all. For example, if they lived in London, they will still live in London, but if their state of mind was negative, London will be like a city at dusk, a dark November day perhaps, it might rain with an overcast sky and they might feel the cold. The houses may look rather more neglected, there could be litter in the streets and other people moping around threateningly on street corners. They may find it confusing that the streets have changed, as will have many of the buildings, but this fact is soon accepted. After all, they are awakened alive and they are not dreaming, are they? Not so negatively inclined people are likely to see London more in the way they used to. They would catch the bus, try to get to work, buy their sandwich at the sandwich bar, go to the pub and mix with others. Many people will simply accept the changed conditions, very much in the way we accept our strange dream reality when we are asleep. This could be due to the fact that we no longer have a physical brain, which is programmed to make sense, consider logic and continuity in order to safeguard our physical survival. If this requirement has been removed, consciousness may no longer feel the need to run these monitoring programs and will more readily accept incongruence, breaks in continuity and other essential physical survival mechanics and acts, in the same way we act and observe during our dream state, where illogical and outright surreal occurrences are readily accepted. I found people paying much less attention to anomalies, even quite strange phenomena are readily accepted and mostly taken for granted, just as they would be in a dream. I've been surprised how quickly people accommodate new conditions and don't pay much attention to what happened before when alive. For example, people on occasion still use money and don't consider it odd when they suddenly find themselves having coffee without even paying attention where it had come from. We have to consider how much of the time we run on autopilot without a shred of awareness of the tasks we are engaged in. Mostly we are just as absent-minded and are hardly ever aware of sequences of routine events. We are mostly preoccupied with other thoughts, and in the afterlife state this unawareness simply continues. Because they think they are alive and awake, they have no reason to contemplate the logic of their actions and simply take reality as it is. They go to a cafe and expect to be waited on, which inevitably happens. I was astonished how powerfully their expectation and minds generated artificial entities and objects out of thin air. When our expectations are not met, it is usually because of a lack of creative energy, which could be due to conflict or negative feelings that are rationalized or glossed over. Naturally, not everything goes to plan or pans out the way we would like, as expectation is dependent on personal power and the level of positive energy. This can be frustrating, but it is also the driving force behind the need to address any issues. If their personal power is weak, as it is eaten up by the multitude of self-centered issues and fixations, people may sit around in a cafe without being served, waiting in vain for their coffee, becoming frustrated at the lack of attention, or if they manage to materialize their order, the coffee may be cold or taste flat. Everything happening is in accordance with the energy that is allowed to flow through awareness. On the whole, there are few giveaway signs that they are no longer alive in a physical world. If told so, they may be adamant in their denial by pointing out that everything around them is as real as it could be and they are fully awake and aware and that there is no way that they could be dead because the evidence shows otherwise. Here is a recent example, the 29th of November 2014 headline, Vistas of the Newly Dead. Interestingly, last night I met the husband of my wife's friend. He had died just a few weeks ago. He had been a totally physically focused person in life, and when I saw him, he looked incredibly unwell, despite him having passed over a few weeks earlier. I didn't quite know what to say because I could instantly see that he was in denial of his death. So I simply said, "How are you, B? I hear you had a bit of a rough ride lately." He confirmed this as we shook hands. His face was bloated and the skin had purple patches. He said something like, "Well, I am surviving." And then he changed the subject, talking about cars. I thought how right he was, saying that without realizing. I knew then that the idea of being dead had not occurred to him, and he was also still feeling sickly, and it showed. The fact that he was showing an interest in cars could have been a sign that he was getting better, I thought, but I had no idea which direction to carry our conversation, and I returned to my body. As far as I can see, this lack of general awareness is responsible for a massive boost in population on the lower non-physical dimensions, which are closest to our physical plane, since the world population has rocketed. If people were more aware, this would not be the case and they would quickly move on towards more agreeable pastures. Every time I visit, I am aware of it, although there are variations in different locations. I felt every time I was drawn into these dimensions, I was forced to take note of this fact, which reflects the state of our current human consciousness. Overcrowding on the lower dimensional levels is representative of our general spiritual state of awareness. The following accounts will give different views of these near-Earth scenarios. The near-Earth dimensions are the levels the majority of people are likely to find themselves in when they die. There will be changes, alterations, differences, but as mentioned, these differences will soon be taken for granted and accepted as the real status quo. Everything that is here in the physical world will be very much in place over there as we were used to. There is a higher dimensional copy of everything, sustained by the living as well as the dead. No dead person will think much of it or waste any time thinking about it. Reality is. We will find buses, taxis and cinemas, cafes, bars and strip clubs. We will find shops and people will pay with money without blinking an eye and receive goods in return, or we may not think of money at all and nobody will be the wiser or take offense. And if the issue rises to a point of awareness, it is quickly dealt with by magically pulling the necessary change from your magical purse, which was already lingering in the database matrix ready to be materialized by an act of intent or expectation. We will get used to holding a cup of tea in our hands just as a result of our intent and give it just as little thought as we did when we had to put the kettle on, although we may still put the kettle on, put the tea bag into our cup, pour the water on and let it brew. We do what we are used to and what we liked and were expected to do, and we are likely to follow the same habits and routines. The physics of this dimensional world work in conjunction with our energy, our habits and our expectation. In my last book I explored the idea that everything that exists or has existed, is thought of or has been thought of, is stored as data in the universal consciousness, which traditionally has been referred to as the Akashic Records. Connecting to this area within consciousness we can access all information. I also promoted the idea that manifestation on the astral and higher levels could be achieved by calling up information from this universal data bank, without us having to create every detail for ourselves. It seems to be the clarity of the energy channel that makes this manifestation possible. This is the way I explained spontaneous manifestations where every detail is in place. For example, if I manifested a car, when opening the bonnet I would find every engine part in place as well, which may only manifest at the moment I open the bonnet and expect the engine to be there. As we will see later, things work out differently when deliberate thought intervenes and messes up the natural flow of this universal database system. On these earth-like levels we walk, we don't suddenly fly just because we are dead, so we walk when we are dead. We talk instead of communicating telepathically. We eat and drink and go to bed simply because we always have done so. Some may find they can do away with sleep and will do so, some will not. Some give up eating because they feel no hunger and accept that they can function perfectly without food, and they will accept it in the same way as we accept sleeping less here or eating different foods, because the experienced reality is more powerful than our memory and new conditions are quickly integrated without much consideration. A great number of people, who have given no thought to the idea of life after death, will quickly take their new circumstances completely for granted in the same way as they have taken their physical life for granted, and will consider their past life more like a dream they have woken up from. Their accustomed lack of awareness will do little to question their new status quo. The best way to understand this is to reflect on our own dreams. Most people who are unaware during their dream when dreaming about meeting their dead relatives will consider this to be quite natural, and it will never occur to them that they shouldn't meet them because they are dead. Even if very strange things happen in our dreams, such as driving a car with two wheels, in our dream we will think nothing of it. If we meet a dog with two heads, we might be surprised, but we will take it in our stride. We are very accepting and very lenient when it comes to our dream content, without having our suspicion aroused in the slightest. This is what happens to most normal people who have been living their lives unaware and in a dream. They will be just as accepting in their new reality, not being suspicious at all when things present themselves as they do. We are likely to accept after-death reality with its strangeness with the same gullibility as we accepted our dream reality when we were dreaming. It is only the more spiritually aware who will be cognizant of the changes and the altered conditions of the new reality. They are more aware of the flow of continuity. If they led a life of mindfulness on earth, they are likely to pass over the low-level states and smoothly transition into the pleasant lands where their external reality reflects their inner tranquility. For those unaware, education, adjustments and learning will gradually help them to make the best use of their afterlife, and over time they will get the hang of it and accept that external environments are in harmony with their psychological condition. Quite frequently, a deceased friend or relative who has gone before is likely to try to put new arrivals gently in the picture, but this is not always the case and not always easy either. But it is the people who realize that they have made a transition from one level of reality to the next who will benefit the most from the changes and move furthest along the elevator to fulfillment and the potential benefits of the non-physical state. Before this happens, most people will be confronted with a new powerful aspect of their non-physical reality, which they may not have been prepared for. This is the fact that with the removal of our physical brain, everything we regarded as our unconscious will be laid out before us like an open book, and everything will be as hard and as real as the road we walk on now. This is the key and most important difference between our physical life and our new non-physical reality. What we always regarded as our unconscious is now appearing before us as solid reality, as hard as our physical world has been. We cannot run away from it or hide it. It will be right in front of us the moment our attention is attracted to it. It will become part of our furniture, literally, our living companion. It will be with us every step of the way and only a thought away. Many people who have been living a life of bad habits and poor psychological hygiene will now see it manifested and reflected around them. Habits will act like a magnet, pulling them into specific environments or attracting equally minded people to them who are of similar inclination. That also applies to situations. If they have been argumentative, they will continue to be and find readily available partners. If they were loving and demonstrative in their affection, they too will find others of similar kind attracted to them. In time, being so intensely confronted with their personal qualities or dysfunction, people will learn to deal with these, resolve their issues, overcome their attachments, free themselves of their unhelpful habits, change their mindsets, acquire discipline and learn all the positive things necessary to raise them out of their limitations. Some will gradually understand the new conditions and turn them to their advantage, but many a narcissist, who has lived a self-centered life, perhaps at the expense of others, may find themselves trapped in a loop they may find hard to get out of. A state of mind no longer takes place inside your head, but becomes manifested environment and inescapable outside reality. To give an example, during one OB I found a woman locked in a white concrete cell without doors or windows. When I talked to her, she was lamenting the fact that she had been trapped and there was simply no way she could get out of her prison. I pointed out to her that if I had found a way in, she surely could find her way out. I then started talking to her and found that she had placed herself into a framework of such limitations that she could not see a way out of it. Most was based on beliefs she was unprepared to give up. I told her she should start by letting go of her beliefs and consider other options and, if she did, she could walk out of her cell with the same ease as I had walked in. In another slightly more extreme example, I came across a man who was gradually being eaten up by a whole colony of white maggots. I immediately saw that he was suffering from extreme resentment and self-hatred, which was literally eating him up. When the maggots of his resentment had completed their work, he was restored once more and soon they began to consume him again. I have witnessed scenarios that could serve as powerful inspiration for devoted writers of the horror genre. But here it was reality that would only change via an inner workout. Rescue missions, for most decent people, it is almost inevitable and perhaps instinctive to want to help when finding fellow humans in distress. This applies to our life on Earth as it does obviously in the lower dimensional afterlife levels as well. In the afterlife state, we find more readily people of similar mindsets clustered together, their shortcomings and problems reflected in an equally bleak environment. Here on Earth, these challenges are not as obviously visible. Visiting whole territories and dimensions marked out by mindsets expressed in rather depressing environments makes for very graphic documentation of how a state of consciousness can mark out a large section of our species, something not readily found on our physical Earth. Obviously, there are even larger territories and dimensions where humankind enjoys the opposite, leading very pleasurable and fulfilling afterlives. These too are reflected in equally luscious and uplifting land and cityscapes, as we have already seen. Finding myself so regularly on the lower dimensional levels at times made me question my own state of spiritual and moral integrity. Was I really that psychologically challenged that I felt attracted to these rather dire states and environments? If so, I would have to face up to this. Though this didn't sit with the fact that I spent an equal amount of time on much higher levels, even dimensions which can only be described as pure heaven states or sublime paradise, and on occasion even beyond these. This and the fact that I never ever felt emotional distress other than compassion told me that there would have to be other reasons for my being here. One that sprang to mind was simply the fact that the near-Earth dimension was closely tied around and interconnected with the physical Earth, so it would only be natural to be caught in it, like a fly in the spider's web, during an out-of-body experience.